I received an email yesterday from Rav Mordechai Kamenetsky, the Rosh Yeshiva of South Shore. He sends out every week, I don't know if some of you may be on the list, where he sends his Parsha Parables, which he's published many books of, each week. And yesterday he sent out an email relating to Tisha B'Av. And in his inimitable style, the email had a story in it and a lesson from the story. The story was that there was a Jew who was in Israel for Tisha B'Av. And the fellow was going to go to the Kotel and spend Tisha B'Av at the Kotel, sitting in Avelos over the Churban. And he found a tzaddik in Mea Shearim before he went. And he asked the tzaddik, I didn't recognize the name of the tzaddik, but he asked the tzaddik in Mea Shearim if he has any advice of what should go through his mind on Tisha B'Av. And the tzaddik said, let me tell you a mashal. There was a guy who had bought a lottery ticket. You see, he was struggling financially. Him and his wife were having a difficult time making ends meet. So he bought a lottery ticket. And he went and he gave the lottery ticket to his wife in the morning. And he said, just please, guard over this. He put it in an envelope, sealed it, said, just guard over this envelope. Make sure nothing happens to this envelope. Just please be very careful with it. It's very important. And he didn't tell her what was in the envelope. And he went off to work. And as she was taking care of whatever she was taking care of at home, she was in the middle of cooking and the baby was crying. So as often happens when the baby is crying, you just want to give the baby something that will make the baby quiet down, to calm the baby down. So I know we've lost many phones in my house because the baby was crying and we gave the phone to the baby and the baby treated the phone very well. So she handed the envelope to the baby. She was in the middle of doing something, just mindlessly handed the envelope to the baby. And the baby started chewing on the envelope. It's tasty. And then after a while, the baby throws the envelope up and it lands right on the stovetop and it burns up. And the woman starts to cry. Her husband left her with one instruction this morning, just please guard this. She didn't know what it was, but she was crying. She was very sad. And the baby was crying because the baby just lost his teething toy. And then the baby's big sister, 4-year-old sister, started to cry. Because the 4-year-old sister doesn't like when the baby's crying. So the 4-year-old sister started to cry as well. Then as the sister and the baby and the mother are all crying, the husband walks in and says, do you have the envelope? We got the winning numbers. We won. Do you have the envelope? And the wife says, no, the envelope got destroyed. And the husband starts to cry. So now you have the mother, the father, the baby, and the sister all crying. And the tzaddik in Mea Shearim says, yeah, they're all crying, but they're all crying for different reasons. The father's crying because he lost all that money. This would have been his ticket out of poverty. The mother's crying just because she didn't guard over what her husband had asked her to guard over. The baby's crying because he lost his teething toy. And the big sister's crying because the baby's crying. So you can have a lot of different people crying over a lot of different things. He said, when you go to the Kotel on Tisha B'Av, there are going to be a lot of people crying. Just try to make sure that you're crying over what you're supposed to be crying about. Try to make sure that the reasons for your cries are as close to the real reason as possible. Tisha B'Av is about the Churban. So we should cry over the Churban. The truth is, I read the email. I just wanted to add to it, or perhaps to disagree on one point. And that is that someone once asked me, why is it that we focus on the Holocaust so much on Tisha B'Av? Tisha B'Av is not about the Holocaust, it's about the Churban Habayis. And the answer is that Tisha B'Av is not only about the Churban. See, if it were only about the Churban, we'd be in trouble. The Dubna Magid gives a mashal. Many of you may have heard this mashal in the past, but it bears repeating. It says there was a couple that got married and they had a lot of hopes for the future. The names were Meir and Bracha. And a year passed, 2 years passed, and they were not zocha to have any children. 3 years passed, 4 years passed, 5 years passed, and they were still not zocha to have any children. Finally, after going through whatever treatments they can go through, and after struggling mightily, inexplicably, Bracha became pregnant. Doctors couldn't explain why, what happened that changed from all the past 10 years. But she became pregnant. And she shared the news with Meir, who of course shared it with the world. They were so excited, they were walking on air. She was going to have a baby. They waited so long for this baby. And the day finally comes and they rush to the hospital. Her contractions are just 2 minutes apart. And they run into the hospital and everything seems to be going great. And Bracha goes into the delivery room and Meir follows after her. And as it's progressing, Meir senses some concern in the doctor's voice. He sees a little bit of uneasiness amongst the nurses in the room. And then, after some time, the doctor says, "Get him out of here." And Meir is sort of shoved out of the room. And waiting in the waiting room, not sure what to do, because what do you do at a time like that? He's just sitting there, and finally a doctor comes out and says, "Listen, Meir, we have an issue here. The baby might survive, your wife might survive, but they're not both going to survive. We can save one of them at the expense of the other. There's going to have to be a difficult choice that's going to be made." And Meir says, "Can I speak to my wife?" He said, "Well, she's very weak. We'll give you 3 minutes." So he goes inside to the room where his wife is and he starts to talk to her. And he says, "Did the doctors tell you what the situation is?" And she said, "Yes, they described it to me." And he says, "Well, I think..." And she said, "I don't want to hear what you think. Good Jewish wife. I'll tell you what you think. You think that this is the baby that we've been davening for 10 years. And I'm not going to live at the expense of my baby. This baby is going to survive. And you're going to raise the baby the way I would have wanted it to be raised. And that's the responsibility you're going to have." And he says, "No, please, no. I can't live without you. It's not going to happen. I can't." She says, "This is what I want." And so it is. The baby's born, and his mother, Bracha, dies. And a week later, at his bris, they name him Baruch, because his mother viewed him as a great blessing, and to name him after his mother. His name was Bracha. And every single year, as this baby grew up, his birthday was also his mother's yard site. So there was always this bittersweet feeling. There's always this reminder hanging over him of what his mother had given up for him to survive, for him to be able to live. And finally comes the boy's bar mitzvah. And Meir is just so emotional. Baruch Hashem, Baruch has grown up to be a fine Ben Torah. He's a wonderful boy. His teachers love him. His Rebbeim love him. His friends love him. And Meir gets up at the bar mitzvah and he starts to recount the story from the beginning. "I met a wonderful woman, her name was Bracha." And he goes through the entire story, all of the struggles, all the treatments, all the pain, everything they've been through. And then he describes that harrowing day, that moment where they had to make that choice. And tears are rolling down his face, and tears are rolling down the faces of everyone in the room. And finally he turns to his son Baruch and he says, "Baruch, today's your mother's yard site." And for the first time as a bar mitzvah, you can say Kaddish for your mother. And Baruch gets up and he says the most emotionless, mechanical Kaddish you could ever imagine. Not a tear, not a feeling. Just reads the words. Seems so inappropriate, and Meir just stops him in the middle and says, "Baruch, your mother gave up her life for you. Today is her yard site. Can you do a little better than that?" And Baruch turns to his father and he says, "Dad, I understand what you're feeling. You loved her very much. But I never met her. I don't even know who she is. How am I supposed to cry?" And the Dubna Magid says that this is the problem that we have on Tisha B'Av. The Ribbono Shel Olam says we had a choice. He was going to take out his wrath on something. It was either going to be on Klal Yisrael or it was going to be on the Beis HaMikdash. One or the other was going to go. And the Beis HaMikdash, so to speak, gave up its life so that Klal Yisrael can survive. And that's part of the Nechama. You wonder why it is that after Chatzos on Tisha B'Av, things get a little bit lighter. When in reality, the Beis HaMikdash was really burning till tomorrow afternoon. In fact, in the Gemara it says, one of the opinions was that if I were there, one of the Tanaim says, I would have been Misakin Tisha B'Av on the 10th day of Av. Wouldn't have been called Tisha B'Av, Asiri B'Av. It wouldn't have been a Tisha B'Av. That's when the Beis HaMikdash was really burning. That's when it was really being destroyed. But why is it that we don't have Tisha B'Av tomorrow, we have it today? Because there's a little bit of nechama in the fact that the destruction happened to the Eitzim V'Avanim and not to us. There's a little bit of nechama in the fact that the Ribbono Shel Olam made the choice to let us survive and destroy the Beis HaMikdash instead. And that's the nechama. But at the same time, the Ribbono Shel Olam asks of us each and every year, I want you to cry. One day, the yard site of the Beis HaMikdash. And some of us cry. Most of us don't cry over the Beis HaMikdash. We cry because we hear stories of people with tremendous struggles. We hear stories of persecution. We hear stories of the Holocaust. And we cry because if you're human, you cry. But we're not crying over the Beis HaMikdash. And the question, of course, begs itself, are we doing the right thing? Now, I looked at when Rabbi Teitelbaum graciously invited me to speak, I gave him a choice of topics that I could speak about. And when he sent me the topic that he had chosen, and along with the list of all the other topics of the afternoon, I saw that out of the 5 shiurim this afternoon, 3 or 4 of them are about the Holocaust. And it's striking. On Tisha B'Av, we focus on, apparently primarily, the Holocaust. Is that the right thing? The Dubna Magid asks the question, the Mashal doesn't answer the question. The Mashal just says we can't feel the emotion. But I think it is the right thing. And the reason it's the right thing is really pointed out in the Poskim already. Rav Moshe writes in the Tshuva, Rav Soloveitchik also held this way. And it's really obvious if you think about what Tisha B'Av is about, that Tisha B'Av is not only about a single event. And if we were to narrow down Tisha B'Av to a single event, or even 2 events of the Churban Bayis Rishon and Churban Bayis Sheni, we're really insulting the full character of the day. Tisha B'Av is about Churban, period. It's about destruction. It's about suffering. It's about every suffering through the generation. The Jewish calendar ascribes character to different days of the year. There are days of simcha. There are days of cheirus. Tisha B'Av is a day of sadness and it's a day of avelus. And it's the proper day, it's the appropriate day to go back through all the churbanos. And if you need a raya, look at the kinos we said this morning. It started out with a lot about the Beis HaMikdash, but then we had about many kinos about many other tragedies throughout Jewish history. The Crusades, burning of the Svarim, Svarim HaKadoshim, Yasara Haruge Malchus, lots of tragedies throughout Jewish history, and they're all described in the kinos. And that's appropriate, that's the right thing, because Tisha B'Av is about all of those things. And if that's what it takes to make us cry, and if we feel removed from the Churban, we're not so removed from the Churban of Europe. That we still connect to. That we can still feel and that we can still sense. And when we internalize the idea that suffering and Churban only happens because we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, that a Churban of Europe could happen because Jews were in Europe instead of being in Yerushalayim, then we realize that it's all connected. If we had Geula, none of these things would happen. If we had Geula, we wouldn't be dealing with all the tragedy that we deal with. And therefore, yes, Tisha B'Av is a day to mourn tragedy, all tragedy. And therefore, that's my justification, so to speak, for speaking about the Holocaust today, and specific focus on the tshuvos that came out of the Holocaust. There's a sefer, a beautiful sefer, 5 volumes, called Shalos Tshuvos Mimamakim. The Shalos Tshuvos Mimamakim was written by a rav by the name of Ephraim Ashri. And in fact, I remember the first shaila I ever got as a rabbi of my own shul 5 years ago, was the president of the shul, had just had a baby boy. And he wanted to know if it's appropriate to name the baby after a tzaddik instead of a family member. It was like a home run for me because I had just written an article on the topic, so it was perfect. So I told him that there are various minhagim, and I gave him all the gemaras, all the marmukam. I said, Rabbi, can I name my baby after a tzaddik? So I said, yeah, it's an appropriate thing to do. The gemara says, Shem Rishayim Yirkav, that the names of Rishayim, we dafka stay away from those names. But carrying on the name of a tzaddik, Zecher Tzaddik Levracha, what greater bracha is there than to name after a tzaddik? Again, provided you don't have any immediate family members that still don't have a name. I said, just curious, which tzaddik are you going to name after? And he said, I'm going to name the baby Ephraim. Ephraim Zalman Margolios? I had no idea. Which Ephraim? I mean, Ephraim from Yosef's son Ephraim? Which tzaddik? He says, no, Rav Ephraim Ashri. He says, you know, I read those tshuvos, and it really just, it hit me. You know, the Mesiris Nefesh that a person can have for Yiddishkeit just struck me. I wanted to name my child after him, and I just wanted to make sure that it was okay. It was obviously more than okay. That's the kind of impact reading some of these tshuvos can have on us. And what I want to go through is some of the he has five volumes, and he writes an introduction to each volume. But I want to go through the introduction to one of the volumes, just to explain like where his mind is at, what he's focused on, and what his goal is, and then maybe go through some of the shilos, and you'll see the Mesiris Nefesh of Jewish people. You see people under the most horrendous circumstances who have this tremendous dedication to the Ribbono Shel Olam, and a dedication to Halacha, to the Kutzo Shel Yud of Halacha, under circumstances like that. And it's inspiring, and it's something that when we mourn Churban, one of the things we look for is we look for that silver lining, we look for something that's going to bring us nechama, and that we can show to the Ribbono Shel Olam and say, look how we act, look how we behave. Don't you want to bring the Geula? And we're hoping we can sort of tip the scales in our favor a little bit. And perhaps by bringing up these stories, tshuvos, shilos, that these tzaddik elyon, these tahorim u'kadoshim asked, and we'll go through some of the answers as well, but the primary focus, I think, is on the questions. It tells you a lot of the history of what happened, and you know, sometimes, I know for myself, I don't really fully appreciate what people went through. I was talking to someone, a family member of mine recently, who had seen a movie, the movie Defiance, I think it was called. And she said, you know, that my grandmother just passed away this year when she was, during the Holocaust, she was hiding away in the forest. So someone in my family said to me, you know, whenever she described that she was hiding in the forest, I always thought like, all right, she got off easy. You know, the concentration camps were so much worse. Like I always figured, you know, which sounds worse? Concentration camps are just, you know, hanging out in the forest on an overnight for many, many nights. And then like when you see that movie, it just changes your whole perspective. Like you don't understand just how horrendous the conditions were, just how terrible it was. Like there's a sense of guilt. Like I really thought they had it easy. Easier, obviously, just didn't think they had it easy. And sometimes you just read through, just matter-of-factly, the way they talk about what they went through. It's really frightening, it's striking, as we'll soon see. First, some words of introduction. I'm going to share with you what Rav Ashri says in the introduction to the third volume of Shalos Tshuvos Mimamakim. And the reason why I'm choosing the third volume and not any of the first two volumes, you would think the first volume is the one that makes the most sense, is because the first volume was published in the early 1950s. And it seems that it was still too early to really reflect. To really reflect on the enormity of what happened. To really have a full picture of exactly what happened. By the time he published the third volume, it was already the late 60s. So he already had a couple of decades of reflection under his belt. And what he writes is that these tshuvos, these shilos that he was asked, were shilos that were asked in the Kovna ghetto. He had written them down as they were being asked. He was a Rav in the Kovna ghetto, and when the Rav of the Kovna ghetto suffered from illness, he asked Rav Ashri to deal with many of the shilos. So Rav Ashri was the one that was dealing with a lot of the shilos, and he was writing them down, and he hid them somewhere. He had buried them. And he went back, and he was fortunate enough to find them, and he thought that it's a phenomenal monument to the people of the Kovna ghetto, and to what kind of people they were. It's a monument to the lost communities. And he starts out by discussing the pasuk by Amalek. Right? The Torah tells us we have a mitzvah of Zechiras Amalek, Zachar, mitzvah of remembering what Amalek had done to us. And the pasuk then goes on and says, Lo Sishkach, and not only should you remember, you shouldn't forget. He says, well, if you remember, you didn't forget. Why do you need two psukim? A pasuk tell me Zachar, another pasuk tell me Lo Sishkach. And he says, anyone who's lived through what we lived through could not possibly not remember. You go to sleep at night, it's in your nightmares every night, he writes 2 decades later. It's impossible for a human being to allow those memories to slip. In yeshiva, in DRS, where I'm privileged to teach, on Yom HaShoah, we had a speaker who was a Holocaust survivor, came to speak and told the boys about his experiences. And afterwards, he was so engaging and he was so good, and his experiences were so powerful and so impactful, that one of the Rebbeim went over to him afterwards, and apparently he's a very friendly person, very easy to approach. And the Rebbe said to him, you know, can you do me a favor? Maybe you can come back tomorrow and just speak to my shir and give a few more stories, share a little bit more. And the guy said, listen, for you, you come here, you sit here for an hour, you listen, hopefully you're inspired, and then it's done. I'm going to go home tonight, and I'm going to cry all night. I'm going to have to relive everything I just shared with you. This isn't story time for me. It's something that I live with every single day. He says, I'll be happy to come back, but I need at least a week. I need to emotionally recover. I need to recuperate. It's impossible. I just can't do this every day. So Rav Ashri says, Zachar is something that you don't need to be told. If you live through it, you remember it. The image is seared in the brains of the people who have seen what they saw. But he says, Lo Sishkach, we need to be told. Why? What's the difference? He said, because 2 decades of reflection show, and he writes in very down-to-earth terms, he says, you know, bottom line is, people want a Volkswagen. And the Volkswagen needs gas, and a little less gas than other cars need, so they want to buy the Volkswagen. He says, at that time, the feelings were still so sore and so raw. What about the Jews who were forced to work in those very same factories? And the Jews who were then taken off and murdered once they were no longer helpful or healthy enough to be helpful. But, you know, people want to get on with their lives and they want to be able to live normally. And sometimes in getting on with their lives, they fail to carry it with them, he says to his fellow survivors. It's pretty shocking. And he says, and that's why the Torah says, not only is it Zachar, I know when you go to sleep at night what's in your brain, but Lo Sishkach, in the way that we carry ourselves forward, we also have to keep it in the back of our minds. And we have to realize how quickly the world can turn on us. And as enticing as it is to say, forget it, it's a new world today, move on, pretend it never happened, Lo Sishkach, the Torah tells us we can't do that when it comes to Amalek, because they could always sneak up on us again. And that's the second mitzvah of Lo Sishkach. He writes, Rashi on Chumash, a startling Rashi on Chumash. Pasuk tells us, Vayakom Paro Laila Hu V'chal Avadav. Makas Pechoro starts, and Paro gets up. And Rashi on Chumash says, Come Mimi Tasa. He got up from his bed. Okay. I figured, where else would he get up from? What's the big Chiddush of Rashi? He got up from his bed. So says Rav Ashri, no, don't you see? Moshe Rabbeinu comes to Paro first and he tells Paro, Ribbono Shel Olam is going to bring malchus on you, and he's going to punish you, and you're going to suffer. And Paro says, who is this God? I don't know any God like that. Leave me alone. I don't believe in him. And then after suffering a little bit more, a little while later, Paro professes an emunah. He professes that he does believe in the Ribbono Shel Olam. So he got to that point where he expressed an emunah in the Ribbono Shel Olam. He believed that God had wrought this havoc on his nation. And then Moshe Rabbeinu comes and says, every Bukhar is going to die, including yours. Tonight. You, the Ish Emunah. It's going to happen tonight. So how would Paro react? So you'd expect he'd be terrified. He's not sleeping that night. Certainly not relaxing. What does he do? He gets on his PJs and goes to sleep. And he goes to bed. How could he? Didn't he believe? Rav Ashri says that sometimes we pay lip service to certain ideas, but we don't really feel them. And Paro, yes, he said he believes. He said, Vayikra l'moshe l'aron vayomra aleim chatasi apam Hashem atzadik v'ani v'ami arshayim. He said it. He said those words. But he didn't really believe. Because deep down, he still thought maybe it was just one big coincidence. So Rashi tells us, yes, Vayakam Paro got up that night. Mimi Tasso, he got up from his bed. That's such a profound message for Tisha B'Av. We say we're sad. We say that we're struggling. That we're crying over Churban. We have to make sure we really mean it. We have to make sure that if we get up tonight, it's not going to be Mimi Tasso the same way it is Mimi Tasso every other night. We have to make sure that there's some sort of impact, some sort of impression that's left on us. And Rav Ashri says it in regards to the Holocaust, but we could say it in regards to any calamity. He says the same as by Kriyas Yamsuf. Pasuk says, Vayaminu ba'Hashem uv Moshe Avda. Klal Yisrael had emunah in Hashem. Well, you know, they just experienced miracles on top of miracles. Is that really called emunah? That's called seeing it. That's not emunah. Emunah are the people writing these shailas in the Kavna Ghetto. That's emunah. He says, no, there's emunah and there's emunah. There's emunah on the outside. Yeah, I believe it. And there's emunah internally. That you really, really, in your heart of hearts, you're really, really in Eved Hashem. And that's the madrega they got to at Kriyas Yamsuf. So let me just read you a couple of shailas that Rav Ashri was asked. Some of them are interesting halachically. Some of them are really slam dunk cases halachically. They're really open and shut cases, not really much to talk about. But all of them tell us something about the Jews of that time and that place. In Chelek Aleph, Simen Aleph, of Shal Sechubas Mimamakim, he writes as follows, She'ela, B'yom Dalid Elul Tafshin Aleph, 68 years ago, almost 69 years ago, Asuar Germanim Tsayid al Chayos Meshotitos Kigon Kalavim Vachatulim, the Germans killed dogs and cats, Vasvo Samlo Beis HaMedrash HaChadash, and they brought them into the brand new Beis Medrash in town, Vahimiso Sam Bemisa Syria, they gathered up these dogs and cats and they shot them in the Beis Medrash. But they weren't okay with that. That wasn't enough for them. That they were mechallel the Beis HaMedrash. That they took a makom kadosh. And they took such joy and had such excitement by being mechallel a makom kadosh. And again, a lot of these themes we read about in the kinos this morning. We read about Titus HaRasha going into the Kodesh HaKadoshim and being mezana in the Kodesh HaKadoshim on a Sefer Torah. Taking his knife and stabbing the paroches. There's some sort of sick joy that our enemies take in dafka going into our batek and asios batek midrashos in our makomos hakadoshim, and dafka there trying to create a sense of chilul. And you know, the Gemara in Maseches Shabbos and Daf Kuf Yates gives a list of things, a list of averos that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of. You know, we often think, I asked children in camp this week, why was the Beis HaMikdash destroyed? And they all said, Sinas Chinam, as they continued to beat each other up. Sinas Chinam, they all know that. And it's true, there's a Gemara that says Sinas Chinam. And there are Gemaras that say, first base of Mikdash Avod Zar, Gila, Raya, Shvichas, Damim. But the Gemara in Shabbos, Kuf Yotes, gives other reasons also. And one of the reasons, and it's interesting, it's instructive when you try to give reasons for tragedies. Each Amora doesn't give a reason. Each Amora gives the reason. Lo nechrav Yerushalayim Ela b'shvil. Each one uses the same Lashon. Yerushalayim was destroyed because of this. Only because of this. We have a tendency to do that sometimes when it comes to explaining away tragedy. To say that it's only because of this. That's not Pshat in the Gemara. The Amoraim weren't so arrogant to say that they knew the exact reason and the only reason. What they meant to say, the Mefarshim explained, was that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed for dozens of reasons. There was no shortage of averos that Jewish people were doing that HaKadosh Baruch Hu could say, look, you don't deserve it anymore. But each Amora was identifying something that if we would have been more careful about, HaKadosh Baruch Hu would have overlooked everything else. He would have said, okay, fine. You're not behaving so well, but I see you're very makbid in that area. And he would have overlooked everything else. And one of the things the Gemara says is that we were mechalal, we weren't mechabed properly, batei knesios u'batei midrashos. By not showing proper kavod to batei knesios and batei midrashos, therefore, the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, and it's the most logical of all of them. And the Gemara gives several averos that are possibilities, but this is the most logical. Right? If you can't play in the minor leagues, you're not going to get to play in the majors. If you can't be mechabed in Beis HaKnesses, Beis HaMikdash, the Ribbono Shel Olam is not going to give you his Beis HaMikdash. With a smaller sense of Ashras HaShechina, we can't handle ourselves. Why would he give us the full sense of Ashras HaShechina? It's so logical. The Midah Keneged Midah is striking. It's obvious. I tell the story of one of the Hasidic Rebbes. There were gezeros against the Jews in his town at the time, and they wanted to go into the shul, and they wanted to make it into a horse stable. To bring all the horses into the shul. And the leaders of the Jewish community at the time said, you know what? We have an idea. There's a hole in the ceiling in the shul. And when it rains, it gets really wet. And if you want a horse stable, you don't want your horses getting wet. So why don't we just go and we'll tell them that the horses are going to get soaked. It's less than an ideal place for a stable. And the Rebbe said, what do you mean? Go fix that hole. And they said, well, no, that hole's our only chance. Otherwise, they're going to turn this into a horse stable. That hole is our only hope. And he said, no, you're missing the point. Don't you realize why the Ribbono Shel Olam is allowing this to happen? He's allowing the Beis HaKnesses to be mechula, to be destroyed, to be desecrated in such a way because we're not mechabed it. We allowed a hole to stay in the Beis HaKnesses. How dare we? Once we show the proper kavod, then the Ribbono Shel Olam won't be mechalal or batei knesios. And that's what the Gemara says. If we show proper kavod to Beis HaKnesses, that's what could have averted Churban HaBayis. And anything that could have averted Churban HaBayis is one of the causes for the Geula. Is something that could bring about the Binyan HaBayis. So Davar Pasha, the Chafetz Chaim writes in one of his lesser known Svarim, that if they were to take up a collection of, let's say, building a Beis HaMikdash, I don't know how much it would cost, it's a big complex. What is a Yankee Stadium? It's $1.2 billion. Let's say they wanted to collect $1.2 billion for building a Beis HaMikdash. It would cost much less than that. Well, let's say they wanted, it's not going to be as beautiful, but let's say they wanted to collect $1.2 billion to collect for the Beis HaMikdash. How long do you think it would take for the Jews of the world to get together and bring all the money? Wouldn't it take long, and each and every one of us would send a check. Even if we don't have that much money. $180. Corner of a brick. That's mine. That's my chelek. Chafetz Chaim says, there's a request for bricks, but it's not through our money. It's through those averos that caused the churban. And we have to be misakin those averos. And when we're misakin those averos, that's going to add the bricks. So it's the chilul batei knesios and batei midrashos. The disrespect that we show. And Rav Ashri goes on and he says that the Germans came in and they shot these dogs and cats in the shul. And the carcasses were smelling and blood was all over the place. But they weren't happy with that. They weren't done yet. They gathered the Jews together. come and witness, come and see. Come take a look at what happened to your fancy shul now. To torture them. This was another practice that they had. In a different tshuva, Rav Ashri writes, a man had asked him if he was allowed to commit suicide. And he said, well, why do you want to commit suicide? He said, because I know that as soon as they take my family, they're going to do what they always do. They're going to kill each child in front of my face, and they're going to kill my wife in front of my face, and only then are they going to kill me. They're going to make me suffer by having to witness it. That was also part of their sick pride. And the man said, I just can't live with, I can't do that. And he wanted to know if it was mutter for him to commit suicide, but that's a different shaila. And Rav Shri goes on, so what did they do? They brought all the Jews in. They singled out certain Jews. You, you, and you, come up, take the Sifrei Torah out of the Aron Kodesh, rip them to pieces, and take the parchment of the Sefer Torah and use it to cover the smelly nevelos, the carcasses of these animals. They had to watch as the Sifrei Torah were being ripped to pieces. And they saw the words of God stained with this horrible tame blood of these nevelos. So what did the Jews do afterwards? They went to the Av Beis Din of Kavna. Why? They had a shayla. Halach l'maisa. Sheyisakin tshuva al kol ha'anoshim shahayu ba'osu ma'imad. How do we do tshuva for what we just did? That was their shayla. How do we do tshuva for what we just witnessed? For what we just sat there and saw? Ba'osu ma'imad ayom. And specifically the people who had to take their own hands and rip apart the Torah. They really wanted to know how to do tshuva. But everyone in the ghetto who heard of the episode, even if they weren't rounded up into the shul, they all wanted to do tshuva. That was their reaction. How do we do tshuva? Do we fast? What do? We don't have any money. Give tzedakah? With what? What are we supposed to do in this situation? That was the shaila. Now, let's do the answers fairly quickly because the answers aren't really the point. There's a Gemara in Maseches Avodah Zarah that we actually read about this morning, in Yonah D'Yoma, that tells us this morning in the Arzei Halvano, we read about the Asar Aruge Malchus. So one of them was Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion. The Gemara Maseches Avodah Zarah Daf Yud Ches tells us, well-known story that Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion used to carry a Sefer Torah around with him. And when the Romans wanted to kill him, they wrapped him in his Sefer Torah. And they burnt him at the stake, but they first stuck some wet wool inside so that he should burn more slowly. He shouldn't be killed right away. He should suffer a little bit. A lot. And the Gemara says that his daughter was there and she said, what do you see? And he said, I see that the letters are flying up in the air. The parchment is being burnt, but the letters are flying up in the air. And I believe Rav Soloveitchik explains, what's the parchment versus the letters? What does that represent? Soloveitchik explains that the parchment represents the physical infrastructure of Torah. Very critical. For Torah to survive and to thrive, physical infrastructure is necessary. We need Batei Knesios, we need Batei Midrashos. But if it ever comes that the physical infrastructure, God forbid, is ever hurt, damaged, or destroyed, we have to make sure that the osios aren't destroyed. The osios represent, the letters of the Torah represents the neshama of the Torah, represents the feeling, represents the relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam, represents what we're really all about. Because if that were destroyed, there's no way to rebuild it. So in the midst of this destruction of getting killed, Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion describes, he's giving nechama and instructions, really. And he's telling his daughter, you see destruction right now, but keep in mind it's just the cloth. And we can find another cloth for these letters. We can rebuild with another cloth for these letters. And that's what we're going to do. And that's one of the sources for what you do when a Torah, Nebuch, Rachman al-Utslan, when a Torah is destroyed. Reminder, I told the story this morning at Kinos, when the Panovich Rav was traveling in Italy for fundraising for his yeshiva, and he called up one of the Rothschilds, lived in Rome at the time, and he said, I need you to bring me to the Arch of Titus. Rothschild said, what? You here on a fundraising mission or are you here on a sightseeing mission? Besides, it's 8 o'clock at night, get some sleep, you know, relax, go back to your hotel, relax, and we'll deal with it tomorrow. He said, no, I want to be brought there right now. I just got here. I need to see it. And they brought the Panovich Rav. I don't know if Rothschild did it himself or he had a driver. Someone brought the Panovich Rav there, and he looks up and he says, Titus, where are you now? I know where I am. I'm still here. And guess what I'm doing? I'm building yeshivos. I'm building Torah. I'm rebuilding the infrastructure that you destroyed. Because you destroyed the infrastructure, but you didn't destroy the neshama. Now that lives on. And where is the Roman Empire? Long gone. But the Jewish neshama survives. And that's what the klaf and the ksav of the Sefer Torah represent. And that's why the Gemara tells us elsewhere, Maseches Moed Katan, that Haroah Sefer Torah Shenisraf, if a person sees the Sefer Torah get burnt, Rachman al-Utslan, the person should be Korea Shtei Krios. You tear two krios, one for the klaf and one for the osios. It's one Torah. Why two krios? Because there are two ingredients in allowing Torah to survive. And we have to appreciate both of those ingredients. And each one deserves its respect. The infrastructure and the feeling and the neshama behind it. And each one deserves its own kriya. Rav Ashri goes on to say that that's true of a Sefer Torah Shenisraf that was burnt. It's not as clear when the Sefer Torah is not burnt, but instead is ripped apart. He says, we know the Minhag Yisrael is, it's a Minhag that hopefully shouldn't have to happen too often, but if someone drops the Sefer Torah, the Minhag Yisrael is that everyone who was there fasts, or certainly the person who dropped it fasts, because we know that that's impactful, it means something to us. The Minhag is even if a person drops, Magen Avraham quotes, person drops their tefillin when it's not in the box. Right? You fast. Magen Avraham compares it to a Sefer Torah. He says, after all, everyone will fast when you drop the Sefer Torah, so you should fast when you drop tefillin. Some people have the minhag to give tzedakah instead. It's not the point right now. But the point is that we understand that the Sefer Torah represents something to us. And it really touches at our core. I was talking to someone a couple of years ago. Rabbi Shapiro, the Rav of one of the other shuls in North Woodmere, was out of town. And someone in the shul was going through a difficult time. Their mother was dying, and he needed someone there, hands-on at the hospital, to be with the family. So he called me up, and he asked me if I can go be with the family and instruct them. They didn't know very much, just on what to do and how to handle things. So I went to the hospital, and the doctor said the woman had maybe a half hour left to live. She lived for like four more days. After a few hours, I went home. I said, call me if anything happens. But I was talking to the family. A lot of time to schmooze with them. And I saw that the upbringing, that the background was certainly not Orthodox. And I was curious. So I just said, how did you end up in our Torah? I'm from North Woodmere. It's like far away from here. But in North Woodmere, there's a very big conservative shul. In fact, at one point, I think it was one of the biggest conservative shuls in America. Now, membership is down to like 450, 500 people. But very, very big conservative shul. I said, we have the really big conservative shul right there. I'm just curious, how did you end up in our Torah? And this woman said, listen to this, unbelievable. She said, We were in the conservative shul one Shabbos. Someone took out a Sefer Torah and dropped the Sefer Torah. And there was stunned silence in the room. Everyone was just shocked. And the rabbi got up and said, "Don't worry, it's okay. It's really not a big deal. It's just a book. We'll pick it right back up." And she said, "That's the day I left that shul. I couldn't be there anymore." Someone's not religious, but the Sefer Torah means something to us. Sefer Torah means something to us. When you drop a Sefer Torah, you fast, because it's worth fasting over. That's what a Sefer Torah is. So Rav Ashri goes on to say that the truth is this minhag of fasting when you drop a Sefer Torah does not appear in the Gemara, nor does it appear in any Rishonim. But it is a very strong minhag. But even so, the minhag only covers those who were there at the time. At most, those who were there at the time, at the least, the person who was holding the Sefer Torah, certainly does not seem to cover those who just heard about it. In fact, when the Gemara says Yiter Kriya, it's when you row a Sefer Torah, when you see a Sefer Torah that was Saruf, that was burnt, that's when Yiter Kriya. Not just if you happen to be there when a Sefer Torah, if you happen to have heard about a Sefer Torah being burnt. So he writes, Ha'olam Mikol Amuva, what results from this whole analysis, again, I skipped most of the analysis, is Vaday Kol Ha'anashim Shayu Bosa Maimidim Ha'adav Rav Sharilahem Tzrichimim L'Sainos. Now, there are a few extra words in that sentence. He says, certainly everyone who was there at the time has to fast. That's how I would have said it. But he throws in the words, Im Hadavar Efshari Lahem, if it's at all possible for them. And he goes on to describe why he threw in those words. Because he said, for the majority of them, it's not possible. Their health had deteriorated to such a point where fasting would be terrible. Where it's mamish sakanas nefashos for them to fast. Those who are the stronger ones, who are able to deal with it or are able to fast, should fast. Those who can't, should not. But he says, those who tore the Sefer Torah with their hands should make every effort to fast. To the extent that, even if they feel that they're very weak, should really try their hardest. Not necessarily give up their lives, but at least give it a shot. And he says, "V'afal pikein oresi l'kalele sheshamu al adavar." What about those people who heard about it? Av sheinu mechuyavim b'taynis, even though they don't have to fast, sheyitnu tzedaka. Kolechal l'fi yicholta v'asagas yado. Give tzedaka. It's very easy for us to say stuff like that, even in today's economy. Give tzedaka. Talmud says, I dropped my tefillin Rebbe this morning. It was by accident. You know, if you're in a shul every morning where there are hundreds of people, and and people come and ask you questions, once in a while, someone's going to drop their tefillin. It happens. People drop things. What do I do? It's very easy to say, give tzedakah. It's a very easy answer. Okay, if I say, give enough tzedakah that it will hurt you a little bit. You know, not just $5. Give something that you'll really feel that it's missing. Of course, it's a little more complicated when you're dealing with teenagers because it's not their money. I'm not going to tell them to give enough tzedakah to hurt their parents. give something that you'll feel the loss. Right, that's you give some tzedakah, but in the Kupna ghetto, it wasn't just give tzedakah. Giving tzedakah was really something. Anything that they gave was a major sacrifice. But he says we have to be affected by what happened, and he said he gathered the community together afterwards, and he led a kinnis tshuva. He didn't get up and say, "Don't worry, it's not a big deal." He led a kinnis tshuva. He took the moment and he said, we have to think about whether we're mechabed the Sefer Torah enough, whether we're mechabed those people who represent the Sefer Torah to us enough. And the Av Beis Din of Kovna was maskim to his psak. That was Shaila 1 of Volume 1. Next Shaila is in Volume 2, Chelek Beis, Simon Gimel. He writes as follows. Vayi ka'or liyom chaf hei menachem av shnas tafshin aleph. 68 years ago. Vani yoshev b'veis Hashem b'veis midrashi. I was sitting and learning in the Beis Medrash. B'slobodko marbitz Torah b'rabim l'fnei chaverim makshivim l'koli. I was saying a shir. That's what I do. I'm a rabbi. Minichbadei ha'idosh yisi noig la'orosim es darkei Hashem And these were regulars at the shir, people who were really religious Jews, very pious people. When our enemies came to destroy us, uva'u al rashenu va'amarnu nigzarnu kishashavas me'itanu kalmasas, they took away all joy from our life, and the cities of Lita were on fire. Kiechachanuchal v'reinu bara asher matza asameinu, and it was difficult to take in all that was going on. Ve'echachanuchal v'reinu ba'avdan arze halavonon adira atora bidei atzar. And the Talmidei Chachamim, the Gedolei Olam, who were being killed, it was difficult to watch. And what was our nechama? Ve'rak kol ha'torah lo nidom, afilu bizmanahu. We found comfort in Torah. We were able to learn Torah, and that was our source of comfort. That's why the halacha and Tisha B'Av, that you're not allowed to learn Torah, it's such a difficult halacha. It should be a difficult halacha. Happens to be, we end up learning more Torah on Tisha B'Av than probably the whole rest of the year, but the halacha is not allowed to learn Torah on Tisha B'Av. It takes away the very source of nechama. And worse than the avelus, is taking away the ability to feel nechama. Very often the nechama is from the Dvar Hashem. We need to feel the Ribbono Shel'Olam's embrace. And we do that through the Torah. And we can't do that on Tisha B'Av. So he said, that was our way of coping. We went and we learnt. And we carried on. And let's skip a little. He says, V'inei oz b'layla hu, v'shafti b'veis Hashem, v'omer ashirai, while I was saying my shir, nishma pitom kol tzavcha v'zaka. All of a sudden we heard a screaming cry. Kol yilala choderes chadrei vaten. You know the kind of cry that really penetrates you? Remember when I was a bacher in yeshiva, I was eating by a Rebbe's house. One of the kids started crying in another room. The Rebbe didn't budge. I said, aren't you going to do something about that? He said, no, that's not a cry that needs attention. You can tell the difference between a cry and a cry. I didn't understand this until I became a parent. You know. Sometimes it's a cry, yeah. But sometimes it's a cry where you get scared and you jump up and you need to see what happened. And you hope that everything's all right. And there's such a cry. And the cry comes mipi kalaso shel echad me'ayoshev makvum al yad shulchan ilumot Torah Hashem. There's a shir going on in the shul, people sitting there learning Torah. One of the people's daughters-in-law was outside, and it was her voice that was screaming. Harav Rav Zalman Shor Hashem Yinkom Damo was the name of the fellow. He is part celebrates a marriage of called Bechi Vinei Sipra. She runs into shul, the daughter-in-law, and she starts telling us Shagermanim Yemach Shemam Otziu Ze'ata Laharug Ezbala, that they just took her husband to kill him. But no, Shal Rav Zalman, the son of Rav Zalman, who was sitting in his shir, B'Yachadim Shloshas Banav Baneha, with three of his children, her children. And here, in just a blink of an eye, she had a lovely family, and it's all gone. Her husband, her children. And as she's going through the story, what happened? Father-in-law hears the daughter-in-law tell the story. He falls backward on his chair, bangs his head, and the father-in-law dies. Like the story from Navi, Eli HaKohen, right? When he finds out that his children were killed and that the Aron was taken, falls over backwards, 98 years old, falls over backwards and dies. The man couldn't handle the news, he literally fell off his chair, and that was it for him. So what's the Shaila? This is one of the most remarkable things about the Sefer, is it makes it so personal. It gives you the names of everybody. In the back of one of the volumes, he has lists of names. Names of shuls, names of communities, names of people that he remembers. And this guy was the butcher, and this guy was the shoemaker. Names. And he says, the Gabbai of the Chevra Kadisha was a man by the name of Chaim Moshe Kaplan, Hashem Yinkom Dama. And it was his job to make sure all the funerals went okay. Kaminag b'nei Yisrael mikademes dina, and were observed appropriately. V'nei hu bala fanai v'sha'ila b'piv, and the shayla was as follows. Hayos sheneschatu ba'achrona gzeros hakasher shel atzorim gam al chayim v'gam al amesim. The gzeros were not only against the living Jews, they were against the dead Jews also. And not everyone was zocha to a kever Yisrael. And he said, it's going to be days. If we're lucky enough to get these people buried, it's going to be days till we can have a proper kavura. And normally the halacha is that the tahara is supposed to be done soon before the burial. He says, I don't know what kind of tahara we're going to be able to do in a couple of days. I don't know who's going to be there. I don't know who's going to be alive. The body's going to be in such poor state, such poor condition, people may not want to volunteer. Right now we're here. We're in the Beis Medrash. You were in the middle saying your shir. He's amongst chaverim, talmidei chachamim, lomdei Torah. Can we do the Torah right here? Can we do it now? Knowing that the kvur is not going to be for another couple of days. That's the shayla that he had to deal with. Again, the answers are not nearly as important as the shaylas. The answer happened to have been that yes, it is appropriate. There's an Afna Tshuva in the Nodeb Yehuda that says like that. Chassam Sofer says like that. In less pressing circumstances even, that it was okay. But I think, again, if you ever have a chance, I have... I don't think these books are in print anymore. I think they translated them. In English they're in print probably, but I don't think the originals are in print anymore. I have it as a PDF file if anyone wants me to email it to them. But the point, I think, is that on a day of Churban, on a day where there's so much sadness, where there's so much crying, we have to be productive in our crying. What I mean by productive is that we can't just cry and then that's it, and let it go on and remain unchanged by it. We have to be inspired by those who were Moser Nefesh so that we can be here. For those who are Moser Nefesh throughout the generations, and yes, to an extent, there should be a sense that we have a lot to make up for, because the world is missing a lot of Torah, and the world is missing a lot of inspiration, because of what was lost. And generations of Mesorah were gone. And it's something that we need to take to heart, and something we need to go moving forward, and be inspired by the commitment. And sometimes, you know, when our conditions are not quite as adverse as it was in the Kovna ghetto, and our commitment sort of fails a little bit, we should be mechazik ourselves. I have a good friend who told me that no matter what the weather, it could be a hurricane outside, he's always going to go to shul on Shabbos, because he grew up in Philadelphia, and the Philadelphia Eagles played a December game, and it was like a Sunday night game, and it was snowing, and it was like 100 degrees below zero. It was freezing. They were from boys. They were buying hot apple cider so they could stick their hands into it to warm up their fingers. Freezing. But they stayed for all four quarters. And he said to himself at that time, you know, if I could have such Mesiris Nefesh for this, I think I could have Mesiris Nefesh to come to shul. And we should be... We should keep in mind the Mesiris Nefesh that people had through the years, and we should inspire ourselves to be Mesake in all of those things that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed for, and be Mesake in all of those Averos, and Mirtz Hashem next year we'll be able to gather again and review how we successfully overcame all of those Averos, and we therefore brought about the Geula.